Welcome to Early Returns, hosted by Jan Baron, a partner of Holtzman Vogel. This podcast examines law and politics and seeks insights from political players in elections, lobbying, media, and the law. Now, let's join our host, Jan Baron.
Welcome back to Early Returns, a podcast about law and politics. I'm your host, Jan Baron. Our producer is Jody Mayer Piazza. Today, I want to talk about the practice of election law with someone who has been doing that for quite a while. As our listeners know, the law firm Holtzman Vogel, where I am a partner, has been a sponsor and promoter of Early Returns. Listeners may not know the founder of the firm, how it started, and what it does. Jill Holtzman Vogel is the founder and managing partner of the eponymous Holtzman Vogel Law Firm. After working in politics and government, Jill started the firm 21 years ago as one attorney in Warrenton, Virginia. It now has over 40 lawyers with offices in Washington, D.C., Tallahassee, Florida, Phoenix, Arizona, as well as Northern Virginia. The firm specializes in political law, but also has significant practices in litigation, environmental law, and land use real estate matters. The firm and seven of its partners recently were recognized by Chambers USA as among the best lawyers and law firms in the United States. Jill is a graduate of the College of William & Mary and DePaul Law School. In addition to being a lawyer, Jill is an elected member of the Virginia State Senate and once ran as the Republican nominee for Virginia Lieutenant Governor. That means she not only gives legal advice to politicians, but also gets advice as a candidate. Jill, welcome to Early Returns and thank you for being here.
Yeah, and thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. And I have to say, given your lineup of other guests, it's a great honor and very humbling to be with you. And also, I don't know if I'm allowed to do this at the outset of this conversation, but I would feel really badly if I didn't offer you some well-deserved congratulations. I feel like that if you had the President of the United States or the Dalai Lama, even as your guest today, it would be anticlimactic after the last week and a half you've had. You both just had a really big birthday. You've celebrated the birth of a grandchild, the ordination of a child, and you've also just been recognized for the manyth time in Chambers USA as one of the prestigious lawyers in the country. So what else can I say but congratulations to you? In addition to, thank you for having me on your podcast.
Well, thank you very much, Jill. And I think it's only fair in return to acknowledge to our listeners that this entire podcast was your idea. And I reluctantly agreed to try it. So it's totally fitting that you are a guest and that we have attracted so much attention to this program. And I want to sort of utilize all of that to let people know a little more about you and what you have accomplished in the area of election law. And in addition to your biographical information that I just provided, I think it would help our audience to know a little more about you in terms of where you grew up and how you decided to become a lawyer, let alone an election lawyer.
Well, in some ways, I'll listen to you say all that, and it sounds more impressive than it is. My beginnings were in the rural part of Virginia in the very beautiful Shenandoah Valley, where I was born and raised. And it's interesting because in hindsight, I look back on it now, and I've often thought, when was I first really interested in politics and law and government? And as I think about it, I realize that there was almost never a time that I can remember that it wasn't something that was really interesting to me. And I think back when I was really a little kid, I had a cork board in my closet in my bedroom. And on that cork board were pictures of Geraldine Ferraro and Jean Kirkpatrick and quotes from them and articles about them. And I think about it, and had I been my parents, I would have thought, she's a total weirdo. But they didn't. And they supported me and all of my interests. And I remember being young and having my mom begging her and actually dragging her to a place where Jean Kirkpatrick was actually speaking at a college in Virginia, and I being just bowled over and so excited. How I got interested into that, I'm not really sure, but I was an avid reader when I was young and didn't have all the things that younger kids have today to distract them because of where I grew up, certainly not in an urban area. And so I think about that was an interest of mine very early on. And then I also think about the fact that I had really good role models around me for people who were engaged in our community and also were good business people and entrepreneurs. So I think I always had those kinds of things in the back of my head to fall back on. And then when I got out of law school, I remember thinking, I know that I have this great passion. I really do love government and I love policy and I love politics. And it never actually occurred to me that that could be a legal vocation. I knew people did it, but I wasn't actually smart enough to know that it could be a legal career. And so I told myself, what I'm going to do is before I commit the rest of my life to the practice of law, which I'm going to love, but I'll never love it the way I love politics, I'm going to find a way for 1 year before I commit to go do something really fun. And I landed at the Republican National Convention, the 1996 Committee on Arrangements in San Diego. And I worked my way, really talked my way into getting a position there as an attorney, a young attorney after having just passed the bar. And that changed everything. So then I abandoned my idea of I'm only going to do this for 1 year because I realized then, oh, wow, this is a whole thing. You can literally run a political operation that is just like any big corporation that has all of its own HR issues and contracts and all of that, but also this massive political operation. And so that was when I was hooked.
That's interesting in two respects. Number one, how you got hooked on it, but listening to you describe growing up as a young woman in the Shenandoah Valley and having two women as your political images on your corkboard in your closet, Jean Kirkpatrick and Geraldine Ferraro, reminds me that you were getting attracted to politics and policy in part because all of a sudden there was a rise in prominent women, which was not usual prior to their arrival or at that time. So it seems to be a confluence of your latent interests along with seeing that a woman can attain certain stature in politics, which is not normal prior to that time. Now, you did spend some years working at the Republican Party and also in the George W. Bush administration. And when you extended your 1 year that you thought you were going to do something other than practice law, you finally did decide, well, I'm ready to practice law. And you didn't go to an established law firm. You decided to start your own law firm, which was unusual also, particularly for a woman in those days. It's not even common today, but you made that decision and started a firm with just as a sole practitioner. What were you thinking? Who did you talk to about doing things that way? Did you get any advice on any of that?
So I made that decision with some trepidation, but I will tell you, I'd had such an amazing experience working in political law at the National Party Committee, at the convention, and then in the Bush administration, I had gone on to be deputy general counsel at the Department of Energy because I felt like, okay, at a certain point, surely it can't be this fun all the time. I must have to go on and now be an energy lawyer. That also interested me in energy policy. And I had an amazing run there working with EPA and DOE. And the longer I was there, the more I realized that I had really abandoned something that was such a unique area of the law. And I had developed a really unique skill set around campaign finance and election law. And people would consistently reach out to me, people that I'd worked with the state parties or at the party committee or just outside groups. And I kept thinking, why did I stop? Why did I leave? And so after having had a really very interesting and very educational experience at the Department of Energy, I decided I really should go back into private practice and do that kind of law. That's where I belong. It's what I love. And I'm kind of squandering a real unique skill set and a talent I have. So I started doing the rational thing, which was naturally to decide, well, of course I go to a big law firm. And I talked to big law firms. And I was actually well into the process of signing to go to a really big law firm. And there are those times in life when you stop and you reflect right now as an older adult and you think about one or two times that totally changed the trajectory of your life forever. And this was that moment when I just pulled back and thought, it doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel flexible. It doesn't feel like it gives me some of the freedoms that I know I want and some of the flexibility to practice the way I would like to practice. And having had some degree of autonomy working at the Department of Energy in a more senior position, I just felt like that's wrong. And I was afraid to do it by myself. But I think I mentioned earlier that I had good role models for people who were really entrepreneurial. And I remember most people told me the conventional wisdom was, of course, you're going to sign on and go to a big firm. But the people who were smart and who I really trusted and who knew me best, like my dad, for example, said, of course, you should do that. You'll never regret it. If that feels right, you will never, ever regret working for yourself. And if you love what you do and you do what you love every day, it's not work. It'll never feel like work. And you already know you love this. And so I remember thinking that, and I've said that so many times to young people who've been trying to decide what should they do. And I remind them of that great advice that I got so many years ago. And it's been the best advice I've ever gotten and the truth every day. I never get up and feel like I'm going to work. It's so much fun. I love what I do. And I did 21 years ago. Now, the difference was, it was a little terrifying. I started out with just me and none of the resources around me that you'd have at a big firm, none of the infrastructure and the technology. But I knew that I knew what I was doing. And I started working with some campaigns and candidates who had FEC complaints, a big FEC audit. I started in Warrenton, Virginia, and I had the FEC auditors come out and set up. We had the best time ever. And I had really good outcomes for my clients because I loved what I was doing. And it didn't feel like work. And if I had to stay all night and do it, it was great. And so that was the transition and the beginning of something that developed in a really intentional way around working the way I wanted to, in a way that would be really supportive of how I wanted to work, how I wanted to later be involved in politics, how I wanted to, you know, get married and start a family. And so the firm really grew that direction, and it's never stopped growing that way. I've worked so hard to preserve that culture, and I've been able to maintain that for the 21 years we've been a firm. We've grown tremendously and made dramatic changes. And as the practice of law has changed, as political law has changed, but that piece has never changed. Really being committed to every person in the firm, practicing the way they want to practice, and really being true to themselves. And it has worked beautifully.
Well, how did you start growing the firm? Who were the lawyers that started to join you, obviously? Because you didn't get to over 40 lawyers automatically. It grew over the last 21 years.
It's funny because it happened by, obviously, necessity. There's always been a lot more work than I could do, which was a great problem to have. And very quickly after I started, that was the problem. And so two people were the initial first hires. The first was a person who had been, well, I guess they happened almost contemporaneously. One was somebody who had been deputy general counsel with me at the Republican National Committee. He later became my husband. So he was a good choice on both. And then the second one was somebody who had been my law clerk when I was at the Republican National Committee. He was a young, genius lawyer who at the time was in law school at William & Mary and would take the train to Washington. And while carrying a full load in law school, did a full-time job for us in DC as our law clerk. And that was Jason Torchinsky. And so Jason had graduated from law school and was practicing and doing great things. And I remember reaching out to him and saying, do you think you would be willing to do some work for me on the side, just as a contract lawyer, because I have way more work than I can do. And Jason was the one person whom I knew, no matter what you asked him or what the question was, it was never too much work, too hard, or something that he couldn't solve. And all these years later, Jason is in this firm. He's a named partner, and it's still the same thing. Nothing is too much trouble or too hard for him to find the answer or a problem that he can't solve. And that's why I've honestly loved working with Jason all these years. And he's helped build this firm around that same culture, making it fun and doing what you love.
Well, there's a lot of longstanding commitments in that story, both personally and professionally. You and your husband have celebrated your 21st anniversary recently. And of course, Jason Torchinsky's name is in the name of the full official law firm name. We always refer to it just as Holtzman Vogel, but just so everybody who's listening knows that the formal legal name of the firm is Holtzman Vogel Baron Torchinsky and Josefiak. And since that's so many syllables because of several Polish names, we just shorten it as a branding matter to Holtzman Vogel. Now, you are one of the very few women who's started a growing national law firm and who is the managing partner of what is, in effect, a multi-city law firm. You've been quite successful. Were there challenges, obstacles, or opportunities, or all of that as a result of you being a woman in what was, up to the beginning of your tenure here, very much a man's world in law, and is still a majority of men who practice in private practice? So what was that experience like as a woman?
Very different, for sure. I can tell you that in all the places where I've practiced law and later even served in public office, women have always been in the minority. And I told you that story about those first employees. And there was another person that I left out, and I'd be remiss if I didn't mention her. And that was the first real administrative person to guide me in the practice of law, and sticking with this family theme, was the first administrative staff person I ever hired in my law firm. And it was a woman who had worked at ORIC in San Francisco as a legal secretary back in the 1970s. And talk about a strong female. She was that. She also happened to later become my mother-in-law. And she was tough. And she was a really good mentor in the sense that together in this law office, we didn't let people run over us. We were really starting to build a structure around a practice that, of course, then I never could have foreseen. But those early months and early years, building it that way with the two people really running it being women was very unusual. And it was unusual for anybody who dealt with our firm, for any of the outside clients, any of the outside counsel. They were all men, 100% men dealing with two women. And so it gave me the confidence to continue to lead. The inclination is sometimes to be more deferential, to make concessions. And I realized early on that if I'm confident in my rightness when I'm right, and also incredibly honest about when I don't know the answer, people will respect me no matter what. And gender did play into it because it's very much generational. And depending on specifically the practice area or who it is you're dealing with, you know, there were lots of occasions where I navigated some very, very interesting conversations around both gender and authority and the fact that I was in charge. But I've never been willing to undercut my own authority. And I think that in management, that's always the biggest challenge, is trying to manage in a way that's fair and not taking out of the equation all those other, you are this, you're a man, you're a woman, you're young, you're whatever, and just really engage with people based on really the quality of their work, their competence, and their character. And so it's always been an issue. I think it will still be an issue. I know women have to, I would certainly say for sure, in politics, it's much harder. Women candidates are treated differently. Women leaders are sometimes treated differently. And women in administrative and management roles sometimes have to act differently. But those challenges, I think I was able to turn into advantages, honestly, at the end of the day, because I think my ability to be more thoughtful sometimes and to sit back and listen more than sometimes my male colleagues have has served me well. And I think made me a more balanced, more open-minded, more thoughtful, and more patient manager. And I also think that being a woman, and I don't want to belabor this too much, but being able to intentionally build a practice around people like myself who could start families and who could really create a really meaningful work-life balance around super successful careers, like many of the women in this law firm have, they would not have been as supported in other places. So I think it has both made the people I work with more successful. It has allowed me to create an environment where everybody feels supported. And I think that the challenges ultimately ended up being great advantages.
Well, you brought up something that I wanted our audience to know more about, that in addition to practicing law and starting this business and growing it, you and your husband, Alex, at the same time were raising six children, and you were spending 16 years as a Virginia State Senator. You obviously were a role model for many young lawyers who came into the firm or got to know you in this area, because you were juggling so much and so many responsibilities. Frankly, I don't know how you are able to spend any time sleeping and restoring your energy with all that going on. What were the challenges there? I mean, that's quite an impressive basket load of professional and personal responsibilities now for almost 20 years?
Well, first, I would say I squeeze the value out of every waking second. And I promise you that being busier, and we all know this about people that we work with, the busier you are, the more efficient you are. And I think that this also made me a better lawyer. It made me a better mom, hopefully a better wife, and for sure a better legislator, because I didn't have time to waste on drama. I didn't have time to waste other people's time. And I really worked hard not to let other people waste my time. And because I had so many things that were so important to me, and chief among them, my family, which was my biggest priority. And when you're not, as a mom, when you're not fully present with your family, the guilt is overwhelming. So I worked really hard to make certain that I was able to be as present as I could in the family, but also as committed as I could to my clients, because I love the practice of law. I never wanted to give that up. But I also love the opportunity to be in the state Senate of Virginia. And so I don't believe that being able to do all those things was a testament to any superhuman female strength, because I think about other women I know who do all of that and more, and they aren't supported. They don't have a supportive spouse as I have, or don't have childcare. So I think about all the other women who don't have the advantage that I have and who work just as hard. It's just that my position was more public and people saw it more and were surprised by it, because you don't see it very often. Until I had my child as a state senator, nobody in Virginia had ever had a child in elected office in the Commonwealth of Virginia. And when you think about it, we're the longest continuing legislative body in the Western Hemisphere. And all those many hundred years, 400 years almost by then, nobody had ever had a child while in office. And you wouldn't marvel at that if somebody was a teacher or they worked in a bank. No one would say this is shocking, but it was shocking at the time. And so I'm really proud of that, because it didn't seem like it was really new ground we should break, but we need women in politics. We need women's perspective. We need a mother's perspective, a working parent's perspective in the legislature when we're making really the critical policy that governs the men and women in the Commonwealth of Virginia. And so I felt like I had real value in that role. And I certainly had real value being the leader in a law firm, the managing partner in a law firm where I had the opportunity to be a role model for women. There were other younger women in the firm who were coming through the firm and matriculating through, starting as young associates and then later taking on their leadership roles. And they needed to see that you don't have to stop or set your career aside to be successful, and certainly to be successful in political law. Because a lot of people would say, you won't believe this, but I'm going to have a baby and it's going to be like around November. Is this terrible? Are you going to fire me? And the answer is, of course not. You're going to be supported. And yes, there'll be an election and it's an election year, and that's okay. You can still have your baby and we'll love you twice as much. But you know, those are the kinds of conversations that most people don't think about and they don't really have in their regular job. You don't have that as a teacher, and you often don't have that when you work at VDOT. You just have a baby. So anyway, I often feel like that I get way too much credit for doing what everybody else does. I just did it in a place where other people haven't done it before.
Well, just to put that in perspective, in the Virginia Senate, how many senators are there and how many are women?
So when I started, I was the only woman in my caucus, and I was for 8 years. And when I first started, there were very few women in the Senate. There are many more today. We're now, I think we're up to like 8 now out of 40. But back then, there were very few. And I was the only Republican woman elected in the Senate of Virginia for 8 years. So you can imagine when they walk in and start caucus every day, they would say, good morning, lady and gentlemen. So I learned a lot, I will tell you that. And I loved every minute of it. But being the only female always has its benefits and it has its downside.
Yeah, they don't call it the Old Dominion for nothing, right?
That's exactly right. Some days you feel like you're just a hair away from powdered wigs. And some days you're really proud of the hard charging ground you're breaking and how modern we are as modern thinkers. But it hasn't been that long ago that there were no women, not even a woman's restroom anywhere in the Capitol.
Today, there may still be the only woman, and you can correct me, I didn't check this before we started today, but are you the only woman nominee for lieutenant governor of Virginia, or has there already been one before or since?
So Mary Sue Terry had been a statewide nominee, but I was the only one for lieutenant governor. And now we have a female, actually an African-American female serving as lieutenant governor, which I'm very proud of. And it was, yes, it was going to be a big deal if I was elected. And what an amazing experience it was. I was happy. By the time it was over, honestly, Jan, I was quite happy for it to be over. I didn't care anymore by the end, whether I won or lost. But what an amazing experience it was. And a family experience to take the kids on the trail and be a statewide candidate was itself also a great education as a lawyer who does that and, you know, serves with, works for candidates, but also as a person to have that experience.
That was in 2017, and it was a grueling campaign. You narrowly lost. Did that experience change you in any fundamental way or your views about politics? What is it like to launch a statewide campaign and narrowly lose and then recognize all the effort and time that had to go into it and not be successful?
I think it changed me dramatically. It was also one of those times in my life that I look back and I think about that experience also changed the trajectory of my life and decisions that I have made since then. It made me a stronger person, a better person. It made me much wiser. And also, I think I used to reflect on people who would run statewide, see how well they would do, how close they would come, and then always marvel at the fact that they never did it again. And I would often wonder why. I mean, they did so well. And having had that experience, you realize it really feels like when you're doing it even, that this is a once in a lifetime commitment, that you're going to give yourself this much, this time, everything stops, really. It's very difficult to do other things well. It was hard to work with my clients. It was hard to be present everywhere I needed to be. And so to avoid that guilt, I took my children with me often and made it a fun year, a fun experience. I went to every county in the state and met what felt like every person in the state. And you really, you get a lot of criticism, you get a lot of praise, you get a lot of media, you get much thicker skin, and you learn so much. And so I feel like at the conclusion of that process, I was a much better educated adult about the Commonwealth of Virginia. I was a much better legislator going back to the state Senate for sure. And I was also a better lawyer. I just feel like I had an understanding. Certainly I do this for a living all the time, working with national campaigns, state candidates, business people. But that was the really such an intense period of time where it was sort of the coming together of so many different kinds of interactions in such a narrow window of time. It's such coming at you at such speed. And it was life-changing. And so when it was over, I came back and it gave me a time to think about what really out of all of these things now matters most to me. And I took a lot there. I made friendships that will last for the rest of my life. And it wasn't about partisanship either. It was a very enlightening experience in a lot of ways. And I took from it the things that I knew I needed to take from it. And then I decided after the fact, that was a great experience, but I won't run statewide again because when it was over, I knew I had nothing left to give. I had left it all out there and I did the best I could. And so I wouldn't do it again, but it was an amazing experience.
Well, you did run for re-election to your Senate seat after that, and your 16 years of serving will end at the end of this year when you've already announced you're not going to run for re-election this November. So that will conclude your personal public service here in Virginia. Are we to assume that that is the end of your personal political career, or is this sort of a break to give you time to think about maybe doing something else down the road? I mean, your kids are getting older now, so theoretically you have even more time to spread yourself thinly at your law firm and in politics.
Wouldn't that be amazing if I had even more time? We could add more hours, put more hands on the clock, add more hours to the day. No, I can tell you this is the end. And in some ways, I think about it, maybe I did it backwards. Maybe I did it all when my children were younger and had all those political experiences and campaigned and learned so much then. But the timing was right. And I'm glad I did it when I did it and how I did it, because I had the energy to commit. And it was actually a good education for my younger family. My children learned a lot. And they met incredible people that they would otherwise never have met had they not been on the campaign trail and had been exposed to all of that. The end of my 16th year in the Senate, it was a really hard decision not to run again. But again, you ask kind of what impact did that statewide campaign have on me? It really helped me understand that, you know, everybody has a contribution to make. You have to decide the kind of candidate you want to be and the kind of public servant that you want to be. And I think I want to be the kind of public servant that makes the best decisions I can for the community that I represent, that I am willing to be independent in the exercise of that judgment. That doesn't always put me 100% in line with my caucus. It doesn't always put me in line with Republicans or Democrats either. But I gave myself the freedom to exercise that independence, to vote how I thought was right. It makes it harder and harder, though, with every passing year to navigate that. And so I realized that I've made the best contribution I can make. It's been 16 years. I would like to leave when I'm ready on my own terms, when I feel really confident and proud of my service, and leave feeling good about it and not at the end of a bloody fight or with a lot of negativity around my service, or just leave in a way that I'm not proud of or just isn't pleasant. And so I feel like these 16 years were really constructive, and I made headway in a lot of policy areas, health issues, K-12, the budget, all the things that really matter to me. And I'm pleased to be finished. And also, I'm really excited about the firm. Our law firm is so busy and there's so much going on. And I know that this is the right time for me to say, okay, I've done that. I loved that public service time. But in order to be the kind of public servant that I like to be, and that is 100% devoted to constituent service, and you're always available and you always answer the phone and you help everybody, after a while, that takes a toll and you can't be as fresh as you were 16 years ago. So this is the right time for me, and it's the right time for me to transition and really turn 500% of the fire hose on to what I really love. And that is the practice of law, growing the firm. We have so much going on and so many incredible people who are coming and going through the practice and each of the cities where we are. And I know I'm going to love having more time to spend doing that.
Well, what do you expect the firm to be doing, particularly with the oncoming election in 2024? Obviously, your principal practice area is political law, so I suspect you're going to be handling legal affairs for a variety of candidates and political organizations. You also do a lot of advising of nonprofit organizations and business corporations and things of that sort. And in the last 2 years, you've opened two new offices, one in Florida and one in Arizona. Are we going to see more offices? Are we going to see more business in different ways than you're experiencing recently?
It's interesting because I've always been really committed to never grow for growth's sake. And I go back to what I said before, we've always had more work than we can do. And that is a wonderful problem to have. And so my goal has never really been to grow or to go to a new city, but it seems that that's happened rather organically. And the firm has grown tremendously in a small amount of time. And it's grown both on the compliance and on the political law side, as well as the litigation side. And each feeds the other. And the firm has also grown and is recognized now for land use and environmental law. And I'm really proud of the new areas where we excel, but also we've remained really dedicated to where we are exceptional, and that is political law and regulatory law. And because we serve all those clients, then it's natural that when they need sometimes litigation, commercial litigation, that feeds those practices, and it's grown just beautifully. You ask me where I see us. Yes, I think it's inevitable that we will expand our geographic footprint just by necessity. I mean, we already practice in all 50 states and we have clients in all 50 states. And sometimes you just have to have a bricks and mortar presence there so people can be there. And sometimes you need a space for lawyers to practice, especially when the litigation practice is growing the way it's growing. And you ask about the 2024 cycle. Every time we have a big presidential cycle or it's a big election year, we always say, wow, we are busier this time than we have ever been. And it's always a challenge to make certain. We're really fortunate because, unlike any other firm, we have a consolidation of an enormous amount of very, very senior partner legal talent. So we have the benefit of being able to firewall off a lot of senior level partners. And so we have the ability to bring in a lot of work every cycle. And this cycle is no different. And that's how 2024 is shaping up. We have consistently the clients that we always have in the political law space, the committees, the nonprofits, the trade associations, the lobbyists who utilize us for compliance work, and then the larger corporations. We do all of that. But then when the cycle really starts to kick up, we start to engage all those other outside groups, campaigns. And because we're in a position to have some really talented senior partner leadership, we're able to firewall those people off. And right now, 2024 is looking to be our biggest, probably our biggest one yet. And so I'm really excited for that.
Well, one of the names that comes up when people talk about the 2024 election is the governor of your state, Glenn Youngkin. You were an early supporter of his candidacy and were quite active in his campaign. What did you do for him in that very important gubernatorial campaign? And what do you predict, if you're able to predict, he's going to do? Because he, as a Virginia governor, he's not allowed to run for re-election immediately after his first term. So he can't actually seek a second term consecutively. And maybe he's in the same position you are, which is, well, that was nice. That was, you know, my term as governor of Virginia, and now I'll go back and do something else, make more money in venture capital and private equity, which is what he did before he ran for governor. But what did you do for his campaign? What do you think his future looks like?
Well, I would just say of his future, we would be squandering a tremendous talent if he just, at the conclusion of this, of his gubernatorial service this term, if he just exits stage left and goes off back into the sunset, that would be really a great loss. He is incredibly talented. And my initial interaction with him was when he was contemplating running for governor. There was already a field of candidates running statewide, and it was a rather mature campaign process for everybody. And he came in late in that process. And most people would say, you don't have a chance at that point. But because he came in late and because he came in with a very different kind of a campaign, he won. And I was delighted because, one, I was the counsel for his campaign. And we helped set up a lot of the processes that made that a well-run campaign from the legal and the compliance side. And it was pretty complex that year in Virginia. There were a lot of issues. And so that was something I was quite proud of. But I was most proud, I think, because he came into the process at a time when, you know, he'd never been an elected office holder before. And we had developed a real friendship at the beginning when he was first sort of thinking about all this and contemplating how it would work and what it would look like and who were the key people that would be beneficial. And so it worked on two levels. One, as we developed a friendship and I realized that this was no regular candidate, that while initially I had said, I will not get involved, I'm not going to endorse, you know, it's only offensive to the people that you represent when you pick and choose, and only offends your supporters when you tell them who to vote for. But he was so extraordinary and had such political talent and had such a good, strong head for policy. And we've seen how that has played out in Virginia. And you saw why he won in a blue state, frankly. I mean, people say, oh, we're a purple state. Well, you know what? Look at Virginia. We're pretty blue. And he won. And he delivered a really strong message. And then he's been a really strong leader working with the legislature to deliver on all the things that he said he wanted to deliver on. And I think he has done a really good job. And I expect, and everybody's question is, well, what is Governor Glenn Youngkin going to do in this 2024 presidential cycle? Well, I think his commitment has been, I need to see Virginia through. We have off-year elections, as some people know. So we're in our election cycle right now in 2023. All 140 members of the legislature are up. And so he has to make some decisions about being committed. And he's made those decisions to be committed all the way through to the end of November. And that puts off getting into a presidential election. But he'll be a player somehow. It's not certain that he'll be a candidate, but I think he will be an influential player somehow in this cycle and maybe potentially in 2028.
Well, it also sounds to me that you will be a player, even if you're not running for re-election to state Senate. Obviously, you are going to continue maintaining a role of some sort here in Virginia and in politics, as well as continuing to run and grow the Holtzman Vogel firm. And in concluding our conversation, which has been terrific, and I thank you again for doing this, Jill, my traditional last question to a guest is, do you have any book recommendations? And I say that very hesitantly with you because I just can't imagine, and on top of everything else you do that we have discussed in this conversation, that you actually have time to read books, but perhaps you do and can share a recommendation with our listeners.
It's funny because of everything you've asked me, for sure, the hardest thing to answer is, what's a book recommendation? And yes, it is true. I don't have time to sit down and read a book. But what I do have time to do is in my driving back and forth to Richmond, which is hours and hours and hours in the car, is I can listen to books on tape. And I can sneak and read sometimes when I'm supposed to not do that. And I have listened to so many incredible books. In fact, one that you featured on your podcast. And so as much as it kills me not to say that that Sandra Day O'Connor book is my favorite right now, it was absolutely spectacular. I was so sad when it ended, but I'll avoid saying that as my recommended book because you've already talked about it. And I was so elated when you had that as your book and your podcast guest recently. But there was one that I read recently that I thought was outstanding. And it was called America's First Daughter. And it was by Stephanie Dre. And it's a story of Thomas Jefferson's daughter. And it tells a lot about the story of the politics of Virginia. It's really interesting. I think there is certainly some license taken on things that might not be 100% historically accurate, but it's an extraordinary book because of how much is accurate that, frankly, I didn't know and should have known. And I thought it was a really, really well-told story about an interesting time in Virginia and in the nation's history, honestly. And so that's a good book recommendation that I've got. It's called America's First Daughter.
Well, thank you. I'm going to look into that. I'm quite interested in colonial, post-colonial histories, especially about Virginia's many principal actors, including Thomas Jefferson. And of course, his wife died early, so his daughter wound up playing a more important role during his political career. In fact, his daughter, I think, was cared for by John Adams. When Thomas Jefferson was ambassador to Paris, John Adams was in London, and Jefferson basically dropped off his daughter to spend that time with the Adams family, because I think he was quite interested in sprucing up his wardrobe with French feathers.
That's very true.
and
it goes into much detail about Thomas Jefferson and his beloved Sally and the time they spent in Paris and the story about all of that travel. And it's really just an amazing history. And I loved it. And you're 100% right about that.
Well, thank you for that recommendation.
And I'll tell you, you know how you can judge how much I like a book? If people in the office are 100% sick of hearing me talk about it, then you know I liked it. And that was the last book where people were sick of hearing me make comments about this book I was reading.
Right. Well, America's First Daughter by Stephanie Dre is the main recommendation. And you have vouched for Evan Thomas's book about Sandra Day O'Connor, First, which has been a very popular and widely read biography. And I would just add to that that for those of you who have listened to Evan Thomas on this podcast, he just released his most recent book, which is The Road to Surrender, about the end of World War II and the atomic bomb, which is also being well received. Perhaps I can get Evan back here to talk about that book and whether it has any connection to law and politics. But thank you, Jill Vogel, for your reading suggestions and for your time and insights on law and politics. I want to thank also our producer, Jody Mayer Piazza, and our sponsor, the Holtzman Vogel Law Firm, of all places. Enjoy listening to all of our episodes on Spotify, Apple, Google, or your favorite podcast streaming platform. Thanks for listening, and I hope you will join us again on the next episode of Early Returns.
Thanks for joining Early Returns, Law and Politics with Jan Behrend. We hope you will join us for future episodes, which will continue to bring you voices and insights from the people engaged in our political landscape.